Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well indeed. I have a topic I'd like to talk about. We've talked a lot about portion sizes, fast food portions. Mm-hmm. We've had some victories in school lunch programs starting to get a little bit healthier. A lot of these victories are proving to be ephemeral. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these victories are you know, the people who favor processed, subsidized processed foods with a lot of sugar and the things that are food trends we're not so happy about. There are a lot of people with a lot of corporations with a really strong financial interest in seeing things go the way they have been going for the last several years.
And those corporations wield a lot of power. They really can move the market. They really can change the way we eat. They feed a lot of people, a lot more people than any little restaurant or even group of restaurants will ever find.
Well, and they also control more of the debate and the dialogue because mm-hmm. they own the television shows, okay? And if they don't own the television shows themselves, they own the advertisement that goes on the television shows and the news shows, and they really have an incredible power to affect the debate. And one of the ways that some of these folks are acting is when people who want Americans to eat healthier and better achieve a victory, very often these people try to hollow out that victory by even changing, by doublespeak, by Orwellian doublespeak. So for years they poo-pooed organic food as something that hippies eat and mm-hmm. beige and not very good and not very tasty. Well then, as the organic food movement has gained victories and gotten adherence among common people.
And as people have realized that food can and should be better tasting.
What the reaction is among some in large food sector is to try and lobby the government to change the definition of the word organic so that more of the foods that are by definition not organic, why organic was created, can be included in it. And one of the things that's happening, although less, I don't know, I don't want to say it's criminal, but maybe less diabolical than that.
Evil is the word I was looking for.
But it's the free market at work, but it's the free market at work doing some bad things. Mm-hmm. It seems as though a lot of the fast food companies responded to people who wanted to see smaller portions. It seems as though the fast food companies for a while were responding to moms mostly who and dads who wanted to see, you know, if their kids were going to go to a fast food place, they demanded a change. And when the consumer demands a change, if you don't make that change and your competition does, the consumer moves. Well, one of the things we asked for was smaller portions. Did you know that when McDonald's first opened, a soda was 7 ounces? and today, the child size of a McDonald's soda, not the small, the child size is 12 ounces.
Well, one of the problems you have with soda
the
small, size of sodas, right.
The small I heard is you. 16 ounces. And the large is 32 ounces.
Yeah. What I was just saying before Francis interrupted me, was that the problems with soda is the way restaurants buy soda, and my restaurant included, if you have a tap system, a draft system of soda, is by the ounce, it's very, very inexpensive.
The cup costs as much as the soda.
The cup costs as much as the soda. So you can add a lot of value, or perceived value, I should say, to the customer just by increasing the size of your portion. Because you've already invested in the system, you've already invested in the cup, you've already invested in the lid, you've already invested in the straw, you've already invested in someone to put it in this vessel. The difference between serving a 12-ounce soda and a 32-ounce soda may be under 7 or 8 cents. So you can add a lot of perceived value by increasing the size of soda.
Well, okay. So, but let's put this in perspective. In the 1950s, the Big Mac was considered a large salmon.
I don't think they call it a Big Mac.
Big Mac's 3 ounces of meat are puny today compared to the Big Burgers, right? So imagine that when your kid goes into the McDonald's today and says, I'd like, you know, whatever huge burger that they want to have.
The Hardee's burger. We'll call it the huge burger.
Right. The Hardee's burger, these sandwiches have like 12 ounces of beef, okay? So what they're saying is when your kid goes in and orders a Hardee burger, you know, the big one, they're a large burger and a large Coke. What they're ordering is what a kid in 1950 would have said, I would like to have 4 burgers and 4.5 Cokes, please. Mm-hmm. And that's what your kid gets when your kid goes and orders a burger and a Coke.
The problem is that we kind of do it without thinking, okay? You go out to a nice restaurant and you order a steak. You go out to some place and you order the 7-course tasting menu. You're kind of... You're indulging yourself in a spectacular or special meal that you understand the consequences of. Your child who goes up and orders the huge burger from wherever, they're just having lunch. It's not a special thing, and it's just lunch.
And when they become teens, it can become a lifestyle.
Exactly.
4 days a week, 3-4 days a week. You know, one of the things that's happened that we were talking about hollow victories before is McDonald's dumped its supersized selections 3 years ago due to the fact that people were reacting. Moms were not like responsible consumers were saying, wait a second, let's get rid of the supersize. Well, they've just changed the names of things. You know, you can't order a supersized soda at McDonald's anymore, you can order a Hugo, which is 42 ounces of soda. Last year, Wendy's rolled out a 42-ounce version, and Burger King promotes a 42-ounce king-size soda. 7-Eleven offers a 64-ounce double-gulp soda. That's a half gallon of soda, marketed as a drink to one person at 800 calories for a drink. And Starbucks sells jumbo-sized coffee drinks that are 600 calories. But here's what happened. Let's take Wendy's, for example. It dropped the fattening-sounding Biggie sodas and Great Biggie French fries and went back to small, medium, and large sizes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a marketing gimmick. What was a medium of French fries is now a small. A Biggie is now a medium, and a Great Biggie is now a large. So instead of a Biggie, you can order a large, but the large is 42 ounces.
That's really large.
The large is 10 ounces bigger than it was 1 year ago.
I see.
1 year ago. So they dropped the names, but they didn't drop the sizes. And actually, this is worse, because now you go in and you order a large soda.
And it's just an impossibly large soda.
Well, and the problem is, give 13-year-olds that much soda, and it becomes a normal part of life, and it's not impossibly large. And, you know, it has large implications for the future of how people learn to eat, because then if you grow up eating like that, you know, your body sort of finds that as its median.
Well, we talk about, you know, that any time that the least expensive choice is going to be the choice that is the worst for you, we're really doing a disservice to society. Because what happens? Okay, well, if you go out, let's say once a week to a fast food restaurant, and you know, you're pinching pennies and your things are tight for you, you're going to spend extra, you know, that 10 cents extra to get the super size because, well, that's a huge value for you. And in turn, what do? You drink 42 ounces of soda when you really all you want is 12.
I don't have an answer. All I can do is speak the truth, and hopefully we can be a little more aware of our surroundings. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today, we're talking with Kathleen Flynn. Her book is The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry, Love, Laughter, and Tears at the World's Most Famous Cooking School. It details her experiences as a novice attending and completing a diploma course at Le Cordon Bleu, the world's most famous culinary school.
Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Now, this book, we'll talk about the book in a moment, but we'll talk about what the book details. You didn't graduate college, work in a restaurant for a few years, and then work your way into Le Cordon Bleu. You came to it for, via a more circuitous route. You want to share with us the journey that you detail in your book?
Sure. The short story is I lost my job. The really fun way to describe that is... I was a journalist and actually went to journalism school. So I went to journalism school, went in, did the whole thing. I interned at Playboy magazine. I swear to God I kept my clothes on the whole time. And then I worked my way out through newspapers and all that good stuff until I was working for a software company that I was the head of editorial for all of the United Kingdom for this large website.
So you had like 25 people working for you.
I did, yeah. It was, and they were all doing the jobs that I had previously done and enjoyed, but
right.
I had gotten promoted because my boss kept getting promoted. So instead of doing something fun, I was now actually just managing all those people.
So you weren't doing the writing that you loved anymore, but you also weren't getting your own coffee anymore.
Yeah, that you know, and there are perks to that. So you know, that's a positive thing, but. I went on vacation from this job that I really was doing well at and was being successful at, but that I really didn't enjoy anymore. In fact, I had a hard time getting up in the morning and going to work. But I went on vacation with my new boyfriend at the time. His name is Mike. And we had a great time. And on that vacation, I realized, wow, I'm really crazy about this guy. But he lived in Seattle, and I lived in London. And so he flew back to Seattle after our vacation. I went back to London. And as I was walking through Heathrow Airport, I got a phone call from my boss's assistant who said, Kathleen, darling, would you mind ever so much not coming back to the office? And in fact, could you meet Jillian in the hotel next door?
Yikes.
And I thought that seemed like a really bad sign.
You're very intuitive. You're very intuitive for a writer. They pick right up on this. It wasn't good.
Yeah, exactly.
And I met her at the restaurant, and there was a cardboard box with my stuff in it on the table.
you were thinking either it's a surprise party or I'm in a lot of trouble.
Exactly. So it turned out that they had eliminated my job when I was on vacation. And, you know, it was one of those weird moments where I thought, wow, I really would never have quit this job because it was such a good job, but I was actually really desperate to quit it. And it was sort of like having a boyfriend that you want to break up with, but he breaks up with you first,
even though you
really wanted to break up with him.
But you're still mad.
Can I tell you, and this is God's honest truth, every girl I ever broke up with, like I would like fantasize about her breaking up with me so I wouldn't have to do it.
Never happened, huh?
Never
happened, did it suddenly.
Never goes that way.
Anyway,
so my job broke up with me, and I called my mother, and she's being human resources, and I said, told her what happened, and she said, oh, no, you have to get another job immediately, or you'll never get hired anywhere ever again.
Right, there'll be that break in your resume.
Yeah, they'll have like the 2 weeks where I didn't have a job and therefore somebody will think I'm very suspect and never hire me or something. But, you know, I called my boyfriend, Mike Klozar, and he was in Seattle. I think I woke him up. It was like 5 a.m. And I told him what had happened. And I said, well, I could get a job in Seattle because then we would be together and we'd be in the same city. I mean, if that's what you want. And he said no.
Can I just say that at that moment you're thinking I've had a really bad day.
I'm gonna call this a bad 24 hours for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's just like wow, could it suck any more than this? because what he wanted me to do was to actually pack up my stuff and go to Le Cordon Bleu because he had remembered years earlier I had told him that my secret dream was to one day study at the Le Cordon Bleu in Paris.
What a stupid idea.
That's just such a crazy idea. So I argued with him, actually. It's really funny now that I think about it. But I said, well, I don't have enough money to do that. And he said, well, you know, you have savings, and if you have to, you can cash in a 401k. And I said, well, I don't speak French well enough. And he said, well, you'll be in Paris, and they speak French there, and there's no better place to learn. And I said, well, you know, I won't know anyone in Paris. And he said, well, you'll know me, because if you want me to, I'll go with you.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
Okay, Prince Valiant.
That seals the deal.
All right, Sir Lancelot, get up on the horse and ride to Paris.
Totally. I know he makes the competition so difficult for the rest of us.
Oh, really? That was hot. So that's what happened then, right?
So that's what happened. So, yeah, he quit his job, and he rented his house, and he came with me, and we spent a year all together in Paris, and I went through the Le Cordon Bleu, and, you know, I thought I'd pretty much just totally impress the chefs, because I had made the cover recipe off Gourmet at least a half dozen times and threw really good dinner parties. And you know what? They weren't really that impressed with me.
No.
I started out.
No.
They didn't know how to hold a knife properly or chop vegetables properly.
You know, I have to say, though, the accomplished French chefs and culinary instructors at Le Cordon Bleu, they don't care what you did at in America. we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk more with Kathleen Flynn about her book. It's about culinary school. It's also about a love story, and you'll hear more about it in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, and we're talking with Kathleen Flynn about her experiences detailed in her book, The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry, about her experiences in Paris attending the Cordon Bleu. Your book is a love story as much as a story about cooking.
Yeah, it is. And it's also about living in Paris, and I would say the other thing that the book is very much about is identity. And, you know, when I was a little girl, I really don't remember ever thinking, wow, when I grow up, I really want to be a corporate middle manager,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that's where I found myself. And
I dream of it
now.
I dream of it every day. Are you kidding? You know what's funny? It was the other night I was working, and the bartenders from, we have two restaurants right next to each other, and the bartenders of the second bar were going home after a legal last call was at 2, and they were cleaning up, and at 3 o'clock they're walking out the door, and the bartender said to me, actually it was the late waiter who stayed with the bartender, who said,
uh-huh.
Francis, what are you still doing here? Why are you still here? And I said, because I've chosen professions poorly.
Do corporate middle managers work 18, 19 hours a day, 5, 6, 7 days in a row? Is that something that they do?
You know, and that's that glamorous culinary profession. You know?
Well, so you did, but you did, when did you decide you wanted to go to Le Cordon Bleu? Since when did you want to do that?
You know, well, it's really funny, because it starts, as so many stories do, with an obituary. And it's such a cliche, but I was actually writing obituaries when I was 22 in Sarasota, Florida. And as you can imagine, that's a really busy job.
Yeah.
Because they say old people live in Miami, but
right.
I think their parents live in Sarasota.
Yeah.
And so I write all these obituaries all day long. And one day I came across the shortest obituary I had ever seen. And it said simply, Gladys Smith, 84, died Saturday at home. She was the wife of the late Harold Smith. And there were no survivors, no services, no directions for flowers or donations.
Or detail of what she'd done in her life.
Yeah, and that's really what I remember thinking. I was only 22, and of course at 22, you know, you think you know everything and you're going to live forever. But for some reason, that obituary really made me think, wow, what am I going to do with my life?
We're going to come back after the news and talk with Kathleen Holt. Kaplan more about what she actually did thereafter with and what her obituary may read. Sounds a little morbid, but we'll talk about it anyway. And her book is called The Sharper the Knife, The Less You Cry. You can find out more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back after the news. 1450 WCTC, it's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Kathleen Flynn. We're talking with her about her book, The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry, which details her experiences attending Le Cordon Bleu in Paris, France. So we talked before the news about how you read this obituary of someone else's. You're a writer. You're writing obituaries. And this obituary moved you to say, you know, at the end, I want to – how did that lead to you fantasizing about going to culinary school?
Yeah, so I was looking at this really short obituary and this woman who was 84 and had no real obvious – you know, had accomplished nothing obvious. Me, at least, in her life. And at the same time, there was a gourmet magazine open on my desk, and it had been turned to a page in the back that said, Study French Cuisine in Paris. And it was an ad for Le Cordon Bleu. And for some reason, you know how occasionally two ideas that otherwise would never converge together did at that moment. And I thought, I want my obituary to read that I also graduated from the Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. And so I cut that ad out, and I cut out that obituary, and I put them up at on my cubicle wall. And they went with me to every other cubicle wall I ever had in my career, which, you know, when I went from, you know, newspaper reporter to being a magazine editor to actually the job where I lost the job in London.
Did you get them back when they cleaned out your cubicle?
Yeah, I did. They were actually in my cardboard box. they did let me, you know, pack up my own stuff and remarkably didn't have security escort me out, and so I thought that was kind of a victory. But yeah, it's interesting that it took something like the signal moment of my life in order to force me to make a decision to go do this thing that I always wanted to do.
Now, let's probe a little deeper into that. Now, you have no aspirations to be a professional chef. Why would you want to go? What about it appealed to you? What, it was just a sense of accomplishment? There had to be something more about specifically Le Cordon Bleu and going to cooking school.
Well, I think at that, you know, if I go back to that time when I was sitting at that desk in Florida, I thought, well, you know, if I changed my life enough that I was able to go to Paris and study at Le Cordon Bleu, I would have done something significant because I had somehow managed to get off the obituary desk in Sarasota. But I think it also was because I really loved to cook and I wanted to feel really confident about it. And I had met Julia Child once, and she had said after this conference, this writer's conference in West Virginia, I sat with her all morning and she took all these notes and she was just so involved and so interested in it. And at the end of the morning, she said, I love coming here because you learn so much. Or actually, she said, I love coming here because you learn so much. And I remember thinking, wow, well, you're Julia frickin' Child. Don't you know everything about food and cooking? And I kind of very politely told her that. And she said, oh, no, you can never know everything about anything, especially something you love. And so I think that that's a big part of Le Cordon Bleu for me. I mean, I'm a writer, but I love writing about food. And I'll never know everything about it. But at least going to school and having this training makes me appreciate it and even want to learn more, I think.
Well, the one of the important lessons of this book is with change comes opportunity, and you have to, you have to jump at those opportunities when they present themselves.
Okay, Mother Teresa. sorry, I do believe that, by the way, but you know, it's true. My question though is, now you've done it. I want to come back, and in the next segment, I want to talk about your experiences in Paris, going through culinary school. But how has it changed your life now? I mean, how has it changed food in your life? How has it changed, you know, your what you do, how you view yourself?
Yeah, I think that, you know, culinary school doesn't really. I mean, it's very similar in some ways to journalism school. I mean, no one can really teach you just write. They can teach you the habits, and they can teach you sort of mythology of it all. But, you know, you really learn it by doing it. And so I think what I learned from the chefs was the discipline and the good habits that put you on the path to becoming a good cook and a good chef. But I'm not a chef because I'm not a chief, which is what that means in French.
Right.
Except to my husband when he, you know, does the dishes.
Now,
well, what I like to talk about all the time when I'm talking to my own employees, or whether it's my kitchen guys or my front of house guys, is that the whole idea here is that that what you learn here is a framework, okay? And then you got to hang the rest of the stuff on that framework yourself. I can't hang the pictures on your wall and make you dedicated and understand exactly what needs to happen. That's got to come from within.
I think, yeah, and I think that's a really big lesson that I learned. One of the chefs in the book was named the Gray Chef. That was my nickname for him because he was, you know, he had graying hair, but he was also sort of moody. And one of the comments he used to say all the time was, you had to goûter, goûter, goûter. You had to taste, taste, taste as you cooked. Because if you waited until you were done with your dish, it was too late to fix the seasonings. And also, you know, if you taste every single thing that's going into a dish as you're preparing it, you know if the stock is good or if the, you know, ham is going to be too salty and it's going to overwhelm it. And I think that it was an interesting metaphor for life, too, that you have to taste everything. You know, you have to really pay attention to all these small details. And if anything changed me in the way I live my day-to-day life and the way I also cook, it was probably that advice.
You
and I'm very careful to taste what I cook now.
You talk about it had to be fairly traumatic. I mean, your French wasn't really up to snuff when you went in it at first.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about entering the Cordon Bleu as, you know, in your position in life as sort of a career change person, not as a student fresh out of
as an adult.
An apprenticeship, as an adult in your 30s. What was it like?
You know, I think I really had these very glossy ideas about what it would be like. I thought it would be very glamorous. I think the culinary industry in general has been, like, hyped up and glamorized so much, you know, particularly here in the U.S. And I thought it would be a lot like the movie Sabrina from 1954. Did you ever see that with Audrey Hepburn?
Mm-hmm.
She's totally fabulous and, you know, and... Yeah, you know, the chefs are kind of tough on her, but she ends up meeting the Baron, and the Baron transforms her, and she has these beautiful designer dresses, and it's all just very glamorous and fabulous. And that's really, I think that there was some part of me that was just naive enough to think that that would be what it would be like. Whereas opposed to, you know, it was traumatic. I had never gutted fish. I really had not done much work like, say, boning, you know, meat. And, you know, I had to break down whole, like, halves of big chunks of lamb and all kinds of stuff.
The world,
it was pretty gruesome. I mean, a lot of times I felt like I was in medical school and having to go through desensitization.
The world has romanticized a lot of the things that you're talking about. The TV Food Network makes it look like, you know, you're just going to be a TV chef. As long as you learn how to cook, you can be a TV chef. But it's a grueling, grueling profession with just a crazy amount of hours and dedication that it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that these people who have become stars is because they've dedicated their whole lives to it, and sometimes to the detriment of the other things in their life.
Right. You know, I wanted a question that I had recently at a talk in Texas, the Texas Book Festival. Somebody said, why aren't there more female chefs? You know, are women not as good at being chefs? And I thought, well, no, because they want to have kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to have... they want to be able to spend time. It's just a lifestyle choice. I mean, I think it's very difficult. I think it's difficult no matter who you are, I think, to have a life in which you work every Saturday night. I don't have to tell you guys. But just for listeners, I mean, every New Year's Eve, every Christmas Eve, every Saturday night, all the times that everybody else is going out and having fun, you know, you're standing in a hot kitchen and working until 1 o'clock in the morning. And I think that, you know, it's, I can see why people get very burned out on it and why it's very easy to forget when you watch Jada and she looks so fabulous, you know.
Yeah, there aren't many.
It's really like
there aren't many of those positions available. The fabulous looking positions. Those are almost all taken. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Kathleen Flynn about her book, The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry. In just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Kathleen Flynn. Her book, The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry. We were talking before about, Kathleen, you said with your experiences as a writer who writes about food, as a graduate of Le Cordon Bleu, and certainly in a network of people in the restaurant business, there was... I would say in the early 90s, there was a whole cadre of female chefs that were sort of breaking the glass ceiling. And by the way, there is still discrimination in this business, not as bad as it was, and there are still glass ceilings in some restaurants. But those glass ceilings have been shattered by some pretty important women. But a lot of the women who were promising young chefs in 1995 have decided to either become pastry chefs or give up being a chef full-time or become a consultant.
Right, consultants for some big food company.
And I think that there are gender choices. Different genders generally, overall, choose things a little bit differently. It's very hard to be a chef, to be a great chef who's cooking at your ranges every night. You know, you see your kids a couple of days a week.
It's not just that. It's very difficult to be 8 months pregnant. It's very difficult to have morning sickness. All those things that stand in a 120-degree kitchen.
But if you have
it's difficult.
But if you have two kids, that happens twice. I think the issue is more, look, a chef, and it's also not just the amount of time. It's the time itself. Like you said, every Saturday. You know, the chef goes to work at, maybe he can push it to where he can go to work at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Maybe. But he's got to be at work until 10 o'clock at night. If your kid's in school till 3 and goes to bed at 10, that's a miss.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I miss some soccer games. I miss stuff like that sometimes. I'm in a position now in my career where I can actually take off and go to those things. But for a long time, I wasn't.
Yeah. Hey, you miss
that stuff.
Kathleen, let's not neglect the other part of your book. I just this last August was in Paris myself, and I asked my girlfriend to marry me in the City of Light. It's one of the most romantic cities in the world. You went to Paris to go to Le Cordon Bleu with your boyfriend, and you married him.
I did, yeah.
Is it something in the water in Paris?
I think you guys are both cheesy, that's all.
Yeah, you know, I think it's...
Cornballs.
I think it's actually... I think you're really lucky if you're there with somebody that you're very amorously interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also had a friend who was at Le Cordon Bleu, and her boyfriend was still in Brazil. And so they were separated, and here she was in Paris, and you pass all these people, and they're holding hands and in love. And I think it also could be a very lonely place.
What was it like to be in love in Paris and having this lifelong dream come true all at the same time and realizing that you're going to be with the man that you were going to stay with?
Yeah, I think that taking the break away from my career really made a massive difference for me in terms of the way that I think I viewed my relationship with Mike. I think that had I been in my state of my career, I think I would have always still put that first. And I think having nothing else to focus on but cooking school and also, you know, my relationship made such a difference. One of the other people I went to school with as well was a woman in the book named Jovina. In real life, her name is Juliana, and her fiancé was in Iraq at the time. And here I am. It takes me going to France, which at the time was during the whole Freedom Prize like time period. It took me going to France to meet someone who actually had someone that they loved fighting in the war. Mm-hmm. I didn't happen to know anyone mm-hmm. who had a relation like a son or brother or boyfriend or whatever, and that made me really appreciate my relationship with Mike as well. And I think that being in Paris for her was very difficult. Here she was as Colombian, and her boyfriend was American, and she's wandering around watching all these people in love, and the love of her life was walking around in the most dangerous place in the world.
Yeah, I have to say it's a wild city, and I've been in Paris a number of times before, but I'd never been in Paris before with someone I was dating, and it. I have to say the city's a little. I've always loved Paris, but it was a little something else.
Francis is getting a little flush here in the studio.
No, Paris. You know, there was some stuff that's funny, like you know, when I'd be in Paris on my own, I'd be like, yeah, Eiffel Tower, Schmeichel Tower, well, that's pretty. Yeah, let's go. Where's the bar? And we went up on the Eiffel Tower, and it was nice.
Did you propose to her on the Eiffel Tower?
No, I'm not that corny.
Oh, because I was going to say, you and Tom Cruise.
Oh, is that what he did?
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Of course, they had to shut down, like, the whole Eiffel Tower.
Okay, you guys are going to make fun of somebody for getting engaged on the Eiffel Tower, and you guys each got engaged in Paris.
And we totally did. Actually, no, I got engaged in Barcelona.
See?
Another A.
Okay, but come on, you're Tom Cruise, you can't come up with something better than that. I mean, you know.
You know, I have to say, it's a very popular place. I actually know somebody else who got engaged in that.
See, I could never do that. You know why? Because I'd be afraid I'd drop the ring and it's all over. I had a friend who got engaged scuba diving. Like, he popped out the ring underwater. I'm like, no, what a fish could eat that? Now where are you? You know what I mean? Just taking it on the luggage in the plane was scary enough for me.
Yeah, totally.
Now, we got engaged in the Tuileries right outside of the Louvre.
Gardens. That's beautiful.
A little corny, but, you know, by a fountain. It was nice. We got good pictures. It was nice.
No, I think that's great. And you got good pictures. That's important.
Kathleen, your book is great. People can find out about it by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll put up a link. You can even pick it up, give it to a culinary student as a Christmas present or anybody who's interested in food. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Great, absolutely. And if they look it up before December 31st, they can also enter to win a trip for two to Paris. They go to my website, too.
Oh, heck, I'm going to do that right now. The honeymoon could be in Paris. I can't let you
plan.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest was Kathleen Flynn. And you know, there's something that we really should have talked a little bit more about the show. There is a little contest there running. If you go right away to KathleenFlynn.com, F-L-I-N-N, F-L-I-N-N, and Kathleen with a K, K-A-T-H-L-E-E-N-F-L-I-N-N, and you can just link through our website, restaurantguysradio.com, they're running a contest where you can enter to win a contest, a trip to Paris.
Trip to Paris, and it comes with their airfare and accommodations, and you actually get to go out to dinner with Kathleen as well.
Yeah, and the Sofitel, man, that's pretty nice.
So that's good stuff.
The Sofitel, I have to say, I don't want to criticize the Sofitel. They're a very, very nice hotel. But you call them, and they're the French hotel, so they always say bonjour.
Sir, you're in Chicago.
You're in Chicago. You don't speak French.
Hello works just fine.
I'm in New Jersey. I don't speak French. Why is saying bonjour to me?
You guys were waxing sentimental that whole show, and I actually feel the need to weigh in on a little bit of that.
You're going
to
wane a little bit sentimental?
Oh, awful. She talked about, you know, having the support of somebody to say, follow your dreams, do that kind of thing. I graduated college. I was a statistician for a pharmaceutical company, and it was awful. And I was in a cubicle, and I didn't do it for very long, but I hated it, and I absolutely hated it. And having somebody there who was my girlfriend at the time, my now wife, having somebody there that I could say, is it okay if I actually don't do this thing that I've been studying for in college for the last 5 years and do something that I really love, was really, really important. And having that structure, having that person that I could, that would give me the okay to go and follow that dream was very important to me.
I had a similar experience. I was headed for law school. I haven't had the place set aside at Seton Hall Law School. My sister was the valedictorian of Seton Hall Law School. My other sister went to Seton Hall Law School. And I decided not to do it. I didn't have anybody like that around, but I'm an arrogant bastard, so I didn't care at all. I said, I'm not doing this.
You had me.
And yeah, exactly. Because you were doing the same thing. So I'm not doing that. So I left the law, you left insurance, and we'd probably live in bigger houses right now if we'd stayed in our first choices of professions.
Yeah.
But we'd be much less happy, and maybe there's a lesson.
And hopefully that would have made you less happy, too.
Yeah, exactly. Come and eat our food. You'll see how happy you can be from our choice of food. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.